This is a CBC podcast.
On June 12, 1972, five-year-old Adrian McNaughton wandered away from his family at a lake in eastern Ontario. He disappeared without a trace. Host David Ridgen, who grew up in the area, goes back in search for answers. Someone Knows Something, the new serialized crime podcast from CBC Radio. Subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Ideas.
Radio for the mind.
They do have their eyes open, usually.
Still at a fairly experimental level, is that correct?
They ran an EEG and turned around and told us that she was brain dead.
You have let's say, a third to a 40% chance of having a misdiagnosis.
We are looking to establish a communication with some of these patients.
I'm Paul Kennedy. This is Ideas. New scientific tools are giving us windows into what goes on inside another person's mind.
Now you're sleeping. You pretended sleeping? Yeah, I know you.
The advances bring hope to families and friends of people who suffered serious brain injuries. Someone who was once judged vegetative or lacking awareness might now be able to show they're still there and communicate with the outside world through a brain scan.
This opens a Pandora's box of ethical problems.
Philosophy student Andrew Peterson is embedded with some of the world's best brain scientists at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University in London, Ontario. For his PhD, he's considering the ethics related to testing for consciousness in brain-injured patients.
And it may not be the case that a life or death question is the type of question that's relevant for them.
Andrew's work is the subject of today's documentary, called The Open Mind. It's the latest in our series, Ideas from the Trenches, showcasing PhD students across Canada. The producers are Nicola Luksic and Tom Howell.
We track down Andrew in the philosophy department, and even though he's a philosopher, not a brain scientist, the first place he took us was an MRI lab, a lab that's world famous for its groundbreaking research.
So this is a Robarts Research Institute, and downstairs is where they have the imaging units.
He introduced us to Laura Gonzalez.
I'm taking you on a tour of where we do the scans for the patients that participate in our research.
Laura's job is to oversee the different research projects at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University.
So this is not a hospital. The hospital is right next door. And we have 2 or 3 Tesla MRI machines here.
I want to make sure that you get the sense of the patient and the family coming in, laying on this table, typically with a support nurse.
The patients who come through this lab have suffered traumatic brain injuries, usually because they've been in a terrible traffic accident or have had a massive stroke.
After a patient emerges from a coma, they're assessed by a medical team and labeled according to their level of consciousness, from full or emerging awareness to minimally conscious, and then at the bottom, vegetative, meaning they're not aware at all, at least as far as medical instruments can tell.
It is a weird phrase, but the term vegetative state has been sort of entrenched in the literature. And additionally, it's good in sort of a descriptive way. It's the vegetative functions that are preserved in these patients, their ability to breathe on their own, their circadian rhythms, etc.
That label, vegetative, is hard for families to hear. And it might be wrong. Studies in this lab raise the hope that the patient is able to hear and understand what goes on around them, and maybe even communicate back to their loved ones. And this is where the cutting-edge research at Western University kicks in.
The head goes in there, and then they're covered with the top part of the coil. See right there, it looks sort of like a stormtrooper helmet type of thing. And you'll see it has 2 holes for the eyes to be able to see the movie. So that goes on top of their head.
So they can watch movies while they're in there?
They do.
MRI machines record brain activity over long periods of time. And here's the exciting prospect. We can use MRI machines not only to look from the outside into someone's brain, but it can be used as a tool for the person inside the machine to communicate with the outside world, using only their brain activity.
That would be extremely useful if you are in a situation where you are aware and awake, but you can't control any muscles in your body.
Patients that we see here are patients who are in the chronic state. These are patients that can be several years after an injury. They do not need a ventilator, like a mechanical ventilator, to breathe. They can breathe on their own. They do have their eyes open usually. They may be open in and out at different times. They do look around, but have no communication, either verbal or any other way. Many years ago, if a patient seemed behaviorally unresponsive, the conclusion was that that person does not understand, and that might be the assumption in the past. With this type of research, what we are looking for is to make a more accurate diagnosis that will help the physicians treating these patients. So that is one aspect. The other one is we are looking to establish a communication with some of these patients.
And this is exactly what made the research at the Owen Lab world famous. It was able to show that through the MRI, some patients who'd seemed totally unaware can actually listen, understand, follow commands, and answer basic yes or no questions.
Here's how the lab test works. The brain-injured patient is placed on a stretcher and they're slid into the MRI machine. Then the patient is given what sounds like a rather strange request. The researcher asks them to imagine playing tennis.
If you ask somebody to imagine playing tennis, specific areas of their brain will show as activated.
It's right on the top of your head.
Kind of where you'd wear a tiara?
Sure, yeah, a tiara, yeah.
The brain sends oxygen there to help all the firing neurons. And that oxygenated blood shows up in the computer data.
And now the researcher makes a different kind of request. Now imagine walking around your house.
Imagine walking around your house. A very different area activates.
Back of your head and deep in the core of your brain.
It could be, if you want to answer yes, please imagine playing tennis. If you want to answer no, please imagine walking around your house.
The fact that they're spatially distinct is really important, right?
Imagine playing tennis.
Top front of your brain is playing tennis.
Imagine walking around your house.
And somewhere at the back of your brain, walking around rooms in your house.
It's very time consuming. It's not immediate, like on TV shows or anything. It's for each question that might take 5 minutes, because you need to be absolutely sure that the activation is purposeful and if they are imaging the right activity.
Once it's clear that a patient can consistently imagine doing those two separate activities on command, here's the next big step. Get the patient to use those different areas of the brain as a way of answering yes or no questions.
To answer yes, play tennis. To answer no, walk around your house. And from that, you've got a yes-no binary code for communicating with the outside world.
So to put this into practice, the lab might start with a simple question like, is your name John?
Is your name John?
Play tennis for yes. Walk around your house for no.
Do you live in Windsor, Ontario? Play tennis for yes. Walk around your house for no.
Imagine playing tennis and then relax. For each question, that might take 5 minutes.
And once you're reliably getting the correct answers to low-stakes questions like that, the door opens up to asking more high-stakes questions.
The philosophical question that comes up in this is, well, if we can ask them a series of yes-no questions, could we possibly pose medical decisions to them? And could they respond to these medical decisions through this sophisticated neuroimaging communication? This opens a Pandora's box of ethical problems, and these are what I'm struggling with in my thesis.
One issue is how to view the person's responses, how to be sure their performance at the tennis playing test can show they also understand important, possibly life-altering questions.
Can we start giving a modicum of their autonomy back to them? Can they actually start taking control of their lives again? More broadly, we're talking about disabled persons here. We're talking about individuals with communication impairments. And we can think of a lot of conditions that beyond catastrophic brain injury that lead to disability or that lead to communication impairments. Thinking through this very difficult problem, this very difficult class of patients may shed some light on how we can interact with those individuals.
So it's about giving people who don't have agency some agency, ultimately.
Giving them a voice again. My question that I'm looking at in my thesis is whether or not we can seek valid informed consent from these patients, and more specifically, whether we can assess decision-making capacity through neuroimaging communication. It turns out it's rather tricky.
The most obvious question that you could leap to is, does this patient want to live or die, right?
That is a question that is often asked in the literature, and it's a question that's natural to leap to. Surely we could ask a patient that type of question, and then they could respond with either yes or no. But does it follow that the clinicians, the medical staff, have to comply with the patient's wishes? And this is where the ethical problems come up. We have to figure out if the patient is of the right mindset, so to speak, to make such a high-stakes decision.
The research in this experimental lab is, by definition, experimental. And that brings up other immediate practical problems, like how do you share the results with the patient's family?
The risk that you run there is that you disclose a false positive result to the family. You falsely tell them that the patient is aware, when in fact they're not. And if you do err when you're disclosing the research results, what type of error is best to make? Is it best to make an error in saying someone's conscious, but you know that's falsely disclosing that they're conscious, right? Or is it better to disclose to the family, you know what, they're unaware, but that may be false?
The scope for screwing up in this business you're in is, the stakes are high.
The stakes are high, yeah.
How then, if a family is convinced that their loved one is conscious but unable to communicate, how do you communicate the research that goes on here if the MRI machine doesn't detect what they assume is happening?
In two words, very carefully. The way that information has to be disclosed is it has to be disclosed as what's called a null result. It's basically just, we didn't find anything. That doesn't mean the individual is unconscious or is unaware. It just means that we didn't find any evidence of that. I mean, and that's all we can really say, too. I mean, we can't actually say that the patient is, in fact, unaware. We can't actually say that the patient is, in fact, unaware.
It's one thing to talk about these tricky questions in the abstract, but Andrew's work as a philosopher puts him in direct contact with the patients and their families, where every nuance in how we talk about consciousness becomes especially loaded.
Dozens of patients have been studied through the Owen Lab at the Brain and Mind Institute. One of them lives with her family near Niagara Falls.
Okay, are you going to talk for everybody? Are you going to do some talking today?
In 2007, Ida Bruni Fraser collapsed. It came out of nowhere. At the time, she was 45 and the mother of a 15-year-old son.
Her son called 911, and then he called Ida's sister, Linda. Linda got to the hospital and was eventually told that Ida had had a cardiac arrest and suffered a series of seizures. She also learned that Ida's brain had been deprived of oxygen for about 30 minutes.
And I kept thinking, but she's there. I know she's there.
That's Linda Bruni.
I touch her feet and she looked at me, looked straight down where I was. I said, this is a brain dead.
And that's Ines Bruni, Ida's mother.
Then I go to the other side, and she turn around and look at me on the other side. I go to the other side, and she'll go to the other side and look at me. And I told her that. I said, oh, no, she doesn't understand nothing. She brain dead, no, have a hope, no nothing. I said, well, I do. I believe in God. It can be a miracle. She said, I don't believe in God. I believe in what I know. Well, you know this way, I know that way.
I was with her in the ICU, and I had asked her, I guess you could say a loaded question. I asked her if she could hear me, and if she recognizes her kid sister Linda. I placed two of my fingers in her right hand. I asked her to move her right hand. It took a couple of seconds. Then from there, she closed her right hand on me, and then she opened it back up again, and I thanked her. However, when I informed medical staff, their response was, oh, it's just reflexes. It's just reflexes. For her to respond to me, that can't be that she's brain dead. She is working on it. She is trying to communicate back to us, and I think she's scared. They also ran other tests, and they told us that all our other organs are viable, and they told us to try to convince my mother to be to have her organs donated, and even brought a priest in for part of the meeting. And my mother turned around and says, I came here to be with my daughter.
Told to the doctor, say, how can you dare ask that? It's my daughter. Oh, if it was my daughter, if it was your daughter, but it's not. I want it back, and I want it good. That way she is, it's okay. I can take care.
And she walked out on them. And then she turned and says,
good for somebody else, good for her.
Yeah. So my mother turned and told them, if the organs are good for anybody else, they're good for my daughter. And she walked out.
Two and a half months passed, and Ida was labeled as being in a vegetative state. She was transferred back to a hospital closer to home.
When she was eventually brought back to the Wallan Hospital, the doctor there read that she was brain dead. But in the meantime, he ran some tests himself, and he saw a reaction. And he says, I don't believe she's brain dead. And he says, no, have faith, and I think she will come through. She'll get better.
Come on, Ida. We're going to move you.
Relax. Come on, relax.
Ida. Good. Okay, you're good.
After about 2.5 years, the family managed to get Ida home. She was able to breathe on her own, but still needed feeding through a tube. Linda and her parents felt certain Ida was at least minimally conscious.
They sold their family cottage, built an extension at the back of their house with an accessible bedroom and bathroom. They now have therapists and support workers visiting on a constant rotation.
This massage here, we call it pizza dough.
The case support person today is Linda Gosling, and she's working on stretching exercises.
Ida's eyes are open. She's lying on her bed as Linda attempts to move her leg.
Oh, Ida, come on. Okay, Ida.
Here we go. Give me an idea.
Okay. Normally, see how I'm struggling here to get her leg up? Okay, keep that one down. Usually, when I do this, Ida will naturally bend her leg and relax it, and then I can move it over. So completely, completely manipulated up and down. And Ida's telling me she does not want me to do that today. No? Okay. We won't.
Ida's sister tries to document any time she hears Ida saying things that sound like words.
Kind of difficult to capture every single moment because a lot of times she will talk spontaneously and it's like, well, I don't have a video camera recording this.
But then she pulls out her tablet to show us video of one remarkable moment she captured of Ida a few years ago.
Back in 2010, the day before her son's birthday, a month prior, we kept working with her to try to have her say her son's name. So I've been trying to teach her how to say Robert. And the night before, in the middle of the night, this is just before 3 o'clock in the morning, again, I didn't want to turn on the lights. Cause I was thought, I'm going to videotape it. But I couldn't put on any lights because I thought that would distract her and then she wouldn't say it. So I'm hearing her doing the burr part. Maybe you're saying bra. Some say Robert. Bra. Bra. And all of a sudden she goes, Robert. And I got it on video. You couldn't see it though because it was dark in the room, but at least you were able to hear her say her son's name, and we played it back on his birthday. Because I wasn't sure if she would be able to repeat it on his actual birthday song.
For the Bruni family, medical labels like vegetative are completely useless. Actually, more than useless. Those labels can be life-threatening. The family sees and understands Ida in a way that no MRI scan can ever see her.
Well, a lot of the doctors are skeptical. A lot of the doctors, like I said, went through schooling. And the books say it's like this, and that's all there is to it. That's why I appreciated Dr. Adrian Owen kind of stepping out of the box, saying, let's see what they can do. Let's try it out. What things do we have available to us that we can do this testing to show that they are actually there, that they can function like everybody else? It's just they're restricted as to what they were able to do before but can't do currently.
They signed Ida up for the Owen Lab test at Western University in 2014. Ida spent 4 days in that lab that Andrew showed us. Prior to getting there, she had had an EEG scan that showed types of activity that read as high functioning. For instance, Ida's brain could distinguish between random noise and human voices.
Unfortunately, when she did the tennis test, it came back with a null result. As the scientists hastened to point out, Ida could have been sleeping or choosing not to participate. The null result means no conclusive data emerged from the testing.
Do you want to investigate in that way for your own understanding, or is it because you want other people to understand? Who's it really for?
Both.
I'm hoping that through the study and through other studies that may come, that they will show people that, yes, they are there. Yes, they have their own way of communicating. Yes, to work with them, don't automatically label them, brush them off, and saying that that's all they can do and that's all there is to it. Like I said, with my sister, when she was in the hospital when this first happened to her, after they did an EEG, after they stopped the mannitol, they were the ones that turned around and told us that she was brain dead. And then that's when they turned around and asked for us to donate her organs. And I'm like, but no, she is there.
She's okay, you know. I say, I'm missing you, answer me back. Yeah. I want to hear your voice. Hello, hello, hello. Ma, where are you? Upstairs or downstairs? I want to hear it back. I want to hear you that say that. Can you do it? Huh? I know you. Yeah? I know. She pretended sleeping.
Yeah, that's why I said she does when we're feeding her, right, Linda? Mm-hmm. She does that.
Can you open a hand for Mama? Hmm? No? You're tight. You want to sleep, right? You want to sleep? Answer me. Okay, I'll leave you alone.
And that's just it. Who's to say what there is when we say, is she still there? There are huge consequences when we pass that kind of judgment on a patient.
She's okay, you know.
I want to hear your voice. I want to hear your voice.
We connected back with PhD student Andrew Peterson in London, Ontario.
When you hear the story of a family, I mean, and it hits me each time that I talk to a family, you get this very deep sense that consciousness matters to us in a very profound way. And additionally, that the patient's story, regardless of what their diagnostic classification is, the patient, the person, their story is embedded in the family network. And the stories that the family are telling about this individual are, I mean, they're breathing life into them, so to speak, regardless of their diagnostic classification. So it's helpful, extraordinarily helpful to hear their perspective.
How would you describe what happens to the type of understanding we're likely to have of a person's awareness when our understanding is mediated through what a scientific test is telling us?
Well, one answer is to say that it's attenuated, right? That it's consciousness is an incredibly rich phenomena, and that when we view it through a scientific lens, certain aspects of consciousness may be left out, right? The normative aspects, so to speak.
Something you raised earlier, which I found really interesting, is the importance of saying that it's a null result as opposed to no evidence of anything here.
Yeah.
Or evidence of nothing.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So a null result is, well, we just didn't find anything, right? Versus we found actual evidence that this person is unaware or that this person is absolutely unconscious.
Do we owe more help, support, and kind of sympathy to someone who is more conscious?
Well, I guess that depends if you think consciousness is what moral personhood, so to speak, hinges on. Some would argue that that's not the case, that it's not a matter of one being conscious or unconscious.
I want to know what you argue, Andrew.
Yeah. No, I think that these individuals afford the same moral consideration that you or I do. And the fact that they're unconscious or they're not conscious in the way that you and I are should not lead us to treat them any differently than you and I would treat each other. But I think that it's an interesting question because I think that lots of people would say that, right? But when it comes to the way in which these individuals are treated on a day-to-day basis, when they're in palliative care or they're in long-term support facilities, they're not treated according to that principle. Sometimes they're treated with less care, and it's simply under the presumption that, well, they're unaware of the way in which we're treating them.
But you can't be sure of that.
Well, even if we are sure of that, I think that it's safe to say that we ought to treat them in a way that's respectful. We owe them moral consideration because the fallout of treating them poorly is pretty awful.
Andrew, thank you so much, and we'll check in with you towards the end of the show.
Okay, thank you.
We owe them moral consideration.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. You can also catch us on podcast by going to cbc.ca/podcasts, or you can stream online from our website, cbc.ca/ideas. This episode is called The Open Mind and is part of our ongoing series Ideas from the Trenches, where producers Nicola Lukšić and Tom Howell showcase PhD research across the country.
So Andrew tells us that everyone deserves the same level of moral consideration.
The phrases moral consideration and moral value are hard concepts to picture if we don't connect them to what it means practically. Like, what do we do in a situation? What's the wrong action? What's the right action?
Andrew told us about Dr. Joseph Finns, one of the leading thinkers on just that topic.
Joe Finns has written about this work extensively, and he's one of the most well-known to think about individuals with severe brain injury, how we ought to treat them, and where the ethics should go from here.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever we may be. My name is Joseph Finns.
Joseph Finns is a physician. He's also professor of medical ethics at Cornell University in New York. And he's the author of the book, Rights Come to Mind, Brain Injury, Ethics, and the Struggle for Consciousness.
What's changed about the way you behave around severely brain-injured patients since you first started studying the topic?
I have a lot more humility about what I know and what I don't know. I also want to be sensitive to what the patient may or may not be hearing, because as you know, there have been studies that show that people who look rather inert at the bedside based on behavioral criteria are actually able to process language. That was work that was begun at Weill Cornell by my colleague, Dr. Nicholas Schiff, who did a study back in 2005 where patients who were minimally conscious were read narratives, family narratives. Remember the time, Tom, when you and I went to the beach with our mom, and they played these narratives forwards and backwards. And what was amazing was that when you played the narrative forward, you lit up the language areas in the brain. They were processing grammar, syntax, vocabulary. When you played it backwards in the same frequency spectrum and playing them gibberish, it didn't happen. That gave me goosebumps because it suggested that these people who we thought weren't there were actually there all along, even though we've been treating them as if they're not.
And you advocate for a right to consciousness. What exactly does that mean?
It's more that you have a right to be identified as conscious. That we shouldn't, you know, make those kind of diagnostic errors. If you have consciousness, you shouldn't be isolated and alone inside your own head. What that right takes on is a respect for the personhood of the individual who otherwise is categorized as being not there, when in fact they are there. You know, we are social animals. We need love. We need affection. We need community. So we need to bring these people back and integrate them back into society. And the first and most important thing is to get the diagnosis right. Because we make the error, you know, 40% of the time, which is, you know, if it was in any other area of medicine, it would be highly and wholly unacceptable.
So if I go in, if I'm in this situation and I'm there some of the time, so to speak, I have a 40% chance of getting diagnosed as gone.
As vegetative.
Vegetative.
In that most recent study. And there have been other predicate studies that, I mean, it ranges 20 to 43%. So, you have, let's say, a third to a 40% chance of having a misdiagnosis.
It's pretty bad,
and it's pretty unacceptable. And the fact that we're not more outraged about it is because we have not yet embraced these people as individuals who are worthy of the protections of disability law. When I was writing my book, Tom, I was hearing stories from families. I interviewed over 50 families to write this book. And I'm hearing stories about, you know, people being shuffled off to chronic care facilities before they have had a chance to declare themselves, before they've had a chance to get adequate rehabilitation. And then they end up in these squalid places, these back wards where they're ignored. It's really a tragic story. And I'm troubled by it. I'm thinking, like, where is the Americans with Disabilities Act? Where are the protections for these people? And what I came to realize that it's an issue both of civil rights and disability rights, that this is a marginalized population. And historically, in the history of civil rights legislation, the dispossessed first had to gain the rights of citizenship before they got the protection of the law. So there was a right, you know, there was a right to vote unless you were a woman. There was a right to an education in the American South unless you were a little black kid. And recently there was a right to get married unless you were gay. But from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall, there has been a march of civil rights. And I think this is the next civil rights issue of our generation. But we first have to recognize that these people are individuals who are worthy and deserving of the protection of the law. And then there are laws that can protect them. And those laws demand the maximal integration of these people into civil society. And the way that happens is by restoring functional communication. Hmm. The only consciousness that I know is my own. You only know that I'm conscious. I would hope you'd think I was conscious by the fact that I'm communicating with you. So the restoration of functional communication becomes a proxy for my consciousness, my demonstration of consciousness. But communication, as it also shares an important notion with its cognate community, we put people back into community. We reintegrate them back into society by giving the opportunity to communicate with others to restore functional communication.
Right. So it's not necessarily about bringing them back to the person they once were, but rather allowing them a space to communicate with us.
The metaphor that I like to use is there have been some studies that have shown these folks actually have dynamic changes in their brain, axonal sprouting, new connections between remaining neurons that look just like how young brains develop. And so I think it's, you know, as we educate young children to become who they can best become through education, we have to think of this as a kind of an educational metaphor, that after a brain injury, let's try to make this person as functional and as independent and as capable as they can be to have a life that is meaningful and worth living and doesn't and minimizes the burden. The thing is, you know, with rehabilitation, people get an hour a day, 3 days a week for 6 weeks, and they're done. But imagine if we said, you know, we've got a six-year-old who's got a developing brain, same kind of axonal sprouting and pruning, and we're going to have your six-year-old, we're going to send them to school for 3 hours a week for 6 weeks, and then we're going to say they're done. It's inconceivable. We wouldn't do that for a developing brain. And these brains that have had these injuries are redeveloping, and they deserve a similar kind of consideration because there's a potentiality for additional recovery. A recent study that was done in the United States showed that almost 22% of people who were severely brain injured with proper rehabilitation gained functional independence. These were people who on average had a Glasgow Coma Scale of 3 upon enrollment of their injury, which is as low as you can go without being dead. And these folks gained functional independence. They're able to live independently. And that number is, you know, is better than some chemotherapy regimens. And it's quite a surprising number. When I tell that number to neurologists and physicians and philosophers and medical ethicists, they're staggered that these people who they think have no potential for improvement actually can improve at that level.
What do you see as the big ethical issues that arise from the use of fMRI machines like in Adrian Owen's lab to scan these brain injured people and determine consciousness?
I think that the work that's been done by my colleague Nicholas Schiff and Dr. Owen and Stephen Lorries have really, you know, demonstrated a profound ethical challenge. This discordance between what you see on the neuroimage and what you see at the bedside. You know, Dr. Schiff describes this as cognitive motor dissociation, but it's kind of an ethical discordance between what you think you're seeing and what is actually happening. And I think we have to care to care. I think we have to say that this diagnosis is clinically important and it's ethically important, and we're obliged to do the best we can. If I were the czar of disorders of consciousness, the thing that I would do, I would spend my money first about a year after injury and say, let's be sure that we know what the diagnosis is before we categorize this person often for life, and let's make sure they get proper assessment. And that assessment will be behavioral testing as well as neuroimaging, and EEG also may have potentially a role to help clarify the diagnosis.
Professor Finns, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Joseph Finns is the author of Rights Come to Mind, Brain Injury, Ethics, and the Struggle for Consciousness.
We mentioned that PhD candidate Andrew Peterson is a philosopher, not a scientist. Part of what he does as a philosopher falls into an emerging field known as the philosophy of disability, which involves thinking through the language and the issues in a way that doesn't privilege the able-minded or able-bodied perspective.
One of Andrew's most influential teachers is one of the best-known thinkers in this field, Anita Silvers.
I'm a professor of philosophy at San Francisco State and head of this department. This is my 49th year of being a philosopher at San Francisco State.
As a philosopher who also works with doctors, she challenges us and the medical community to think differently about how to use the word normal.
Most doctors and most people don't know what they are meaning when they define normal. And that's not their fault, because the whole idea of normal or normality in people is one of those bad 19th century ideas. In fact, for most of the history of medicine, the idea of normal was not prevalent and wasn't applied. But in the 19th century, the early 19th century, the progress in medical statistics got everybody excited. And it was believed that if we could figure out what typical, species typical functioning is, that is not merely what people can do, but how they do that,
then we would have a standard that was somehow stamped or endorsed by evolution, because the typical human being, it was mistakenly concluded, is successful or representative of a successful species. And when individuals could not function as the typical human does, then they are in deficit and they're actually a danger to the species. It's taken a very long time. We certainly have not been thoroughly successful in replacing the role of appeals to normality in medicine.
And what you're suggesting there, it's almost like today the medical standards have like a slight taint of, dare I say, eugenics?
Well, you're very astute. The excitement about applying medical statistics and identifying what's typical of human beings immediately led to eugenics, because it looked as if science was endorsing a standard for human beings, and that standard for human beings was the standard human, and the standard human was an individual who represented a successful species. So then the eugenics movement could get itself really worked up about the threat of non-standard humans as not only a burden to the general population, but as a possible source of the eroding of the human species.
And can you talk about how those assumptions about normality influenced your own experience with the medical community?
Well, I'm a person who is a partial quadriplegic from polio, which I had as a child. And so when I talk about the impact of very severe illness or injury on the individual, I'm really talking about my experience and the experience of other people like me when we say we're not the same person. We're not the same person for at least two reasons. Other people don't treat us in the same way, and we can't function as we used to. So now I have experiences. I've lived to my late 70s, and I'm still working full time, but I'm physically not species typical. And I know that for myself and people like me, I can, it's not exactly a matter of my threatening young physicians especially, who've never seen anybody who's had polio, but I know that they can feel threatened because I don't function in the same way as other people do, even though they have signs, for example, that I oxygenate my blood just as nicely as anybody else because I have a paralyzed diaphragm muscle, and therefore I use my stomach to help me breathe, that I know can be extraordinarily upsetting to physicians. Does that give you some sense of why it might also be very upsetting to physicians to think that we would have patients who we should treat as persons, but who can't engage in the usual responses that we rely on in order to determine capacity?
I think so. So your own experience, even though, of course, it's totally different from the experience of a brain injured person, this has helped you empathize with a person in this circumstance we're talking about, where they may not even be thinking abstractly or thinking in a way that we would think of as conscious.
No, this isn't. I don't empathize with them. I understand the experience that an individual might have being unable to move and yet having at least some awareness. And I especially understand, because I've had something like this, the experience an individual might have of people coming in and out. And you yourself understand in some ways what is happening, but you can't get anything out to get their attention. Now, what I'm describing is actually more of what we would call a locked-in state than the state of somebody who is brain injured. But it's not too different. What my own experience tells me, however, is that when we determine who is a full person and who is not, and then treat them according to our determination of their personhood, given our current concept of personhood, we often miss what they can do just because they don't do it in the usual way. So I'm supportive of the kind of research that Andrew Peterson is doing. It's focused on, are there ways that we can more sensitively and precisely determine what this minimally conscious person, or this even this a person who's in a vegetative state, what they can do and what they can't do. And I think that's very important. It's very important to attend to what they can do rather than be obsessed with what they can't do.
Professor Silvers, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed this. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Anita Silvers heads the philosophy department at San Francisco State University. So it's time to touch base again with PhD student Andrew Peterson. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First question. Earlier, Dr. Finns compared brain-injured people to kids in school. He said he wouldn't put a six-year-old in school for 6 weeks, pull them out again, and say, that's it, there's no use doing anything else to assist their brain development. And there are two interesting claims in that. First, that we should see people as having new, young brains with fresh potential, not just damaged brains that would be hard to repair. And second, as a consequence of that, we should go to great lengths, like years of education, to establish linguistic communication with people who have severe brain injuries and even people who appear to be in a vegetative state, even if we don't see any signs of awareness. What do you make of those claims?
Yeah, so I think the first claim is interesting and right. They are new brains. It is a new person, so to speak, after brain injury. We're not just repairing brains. In terms of the great lengths that we would go to, I generally agree with this too. There's a more fine-grained answer that we can give, though. So the way that Dr. Finns is speaking is he's describing neurorehabilitation. But I think that the lengths that we ought to go extend to many different levels, right? There's also the scientific level, making sure that we're paying attention to the scientific tools that we're using and thinking long and hard about if we're getting the right type of evidence and how we can refine these tools. And then there's the philosophical bit, and that's thinking about the evidence that's acquired from these tools and how that evidence bears on the attribution of awareness in these patients.
There is a finite amount of resource, usually.
Exactly right.
And so I guess the question is, how much should we be considering the cost of rehabilitating, reaching out to someone when there's only so much money in the healthcare
right.
system to go around?
Right. And you can be really crude about this, right? You can do a really crude cost-benefit analysis. The amount of resources that we're putting in to support these patients, is it worth the outcome? And I think that there's a knee-jerk reaction that we can give to that. The knee-jerk reaction is, of course not. Some would argue that these are lives that are not worth living, and it follows that we shouldn't invest resources to keeping these individuals alive, particularly when we get evidence from all different types of neuroimaging technologies, EEG technologies, neurobehavioral exams that suggest that a patient is unaware. But then you come face to face with the families, of course, that are caring for these individuals, and you hear their stories. And additionally, you come face to face with the perspective that someone like Professor Silvers gives, which is that people who have injuries can live extraordinary lives after injury, and that they become different individuals after injury. Anita Silvers is a paramount example of this. She has done very remarkable things after injury, after her condition.
But she's still there, so to speak. I mean, that's...
She's conscious.
Yeah.
She's communicating.
Sure. You're right. So there are relevant disanalogies here, and I think that that's a fair objection. But I think that the point still remains, when we think long and hard about these individuals and the lives that they could have, that perhaps a good portion of them may have lives that are worth living, may have lives that would flourish after injury.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, is it too flippant to say that your job as a philosopher, in a way, is to point out how little certainty there is in what we know, how many risks of the unknown there are, and to take simple-sounding questions and knee-jerk reactions and say, no, these are much more complicated questions?
Yes, that's one way to put what philosophers do. I think, to put it in a nutshell, philosophers are really good at asking questions, and we're not very good at answering questions. But in asking questions, I think we're quite good at teasing apart what the problem is and thinking clearly about what the problem is.
And you're finishing up your PhD right now, and after the years you spent working on your PhD, could you boil down in just a few seconds, if even that's possible, what is the key argument you want to make?
Sure. So I'll put it this way. I'll latch on to something that Dr. Finn said. Dr. Finn said that we really ought to make an effort to establish functional communication with these individuals. And the way that I like to think about my thesis is that the science has unlocked the voice, but what I want to do in my thesis is empower the voice of these individuals. This is very difficult to do with regard to these patients, considering, one, that they're brain injured, and additionally because the way in which we communicate with them is this, that there's a very narrow bandwidth. We're restricted quite a bit just because of neuroimaging technology. In the thesis, what I do is I present and defend a position that would allow these individuals to participate in medical decision-making. And I argue it's low to medium stakes medical decisions. It's not the high stakes medical decisions like end-of-life decisions like we've talked about, but low stakes medical decisions, medical decisions that presumably would be important for the families of these patients and for the patients themselves. The world can be much more complicated than the way in which philosophers typically conceive of the world. In the philosophy classroom, we think about thought experiments, and we conceive of the world in these abstract ways to try to tease out the differences in concepts and the way in which we use language, etc. But the world is a really messy place, and particularly in the medical ethics context. The healthcare context raises so many issues that are not black and white. Philosophers can contribute to that because they can help physicians to think clearly through these problems, potential solutions to those problems.
Andrew, it's been a thrill to get a peek into your intellectual world and meet some of the people that are involved in what you're thinking about. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Be useful in the world.
You were listening to The Open Mind. It's the latest in our series Ideas from the Trenches, where we showcase the work of PhD students across the country. The producers are Nikola Lukšić and Tom Howell. Head to our website, cbc.ca/ideas, for more about our guests in this episode and for links to the amazing work being done at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University. Thanks to all our guests.
My name is Laura Gonzalez.
Linda Gosling.
Linda Bruni. And I live with both of my parents, Ines and Mike Bruni, as well as my sister, Ida.
My name is Joseph Finns.
Anita Silvers.
My name is Andrew Peterson, and I'm a philosophy PhD student.
Special thanks to our colleagues at the CBC studios in London, Ontario, and New York City, as well as to freelance producer Hannah Kingsley Ma in San Francisco. Studio technician Dave Field. Associate producer Liz Nagy. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy. For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.